Representing the government this evening is Creighton University. Please, go ahead. The Prime Minister this evening is Ryan Sirik. The member of government this evening is Brian Massey. Leader of opposition is Jeff Brodack. And the member of government is Bill Herman. And they represented the opposition from Colorado State University. With that, I would like to call this House to order and ask the Prime Minister to deliver the first constructive speech. The motion before the House is that housing should be a basic human right.
Before we get started with any sort of debating today, I have to come to the realization that I'm never going to actually win an Academy Award. I know, it's shocking. As such, this is probably the only chance I'll get to reenact such an occasion with this many people in the room. I'm so surprised, I never thought I'd be here. You like me, you really like me. But really what I need to do is thank some people. And the first thing we need to do is thank Skip Rutledge and the Point Loma coaches, team, staff, and administration for great time. We'd also like to thank Robert Trapp, the tournament director and NCDA president, for his 4 years of fantastic service. Also, Renee Gernand, the NCDA Executive Secretary, and Brent Northup, the NCDA Treasurer. And on a little bit more of a personal level, of course, the coaches who made all this possible are Rock, Marty Burkholz, and Susan Helbusch. I might have looked down like I needed to remember that. And also those volunteer coaches which made this possible as well, Christy Collison, Patty Steck, John Cote, David Durgo, and Doug Swinzer, who are all very valuable to this program. Those members of the Creighton administration, probably Michael Chair, the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, Dr. Charles Daugherty, the Vice President of Academic Affairs, Dr. Marianne Danielson, the Chair of the Department of Communication Studies, and of course, Father Robert Morrison, the President of Creighton University. And just one more thanks, of course, to everybody here for coming, to the judges, and all the judges who had to listen to us thus far. So with that said and done, let's move directly into the debate, and let the time begin now, I suppose. We were given the idea, or the resolution, that housing should be a basic human right. Well, this resolution is one of the reasons why I actually enjoy debate sometimes. It allows us to take a social stance, which is very important and completely valuable to society, and allows us to discuss this. And when we look at such an important and valuable idea, it automatically focuses us on the rights of those who definitely need protecting more than others, the rights of children. We need to define then some terms for you. Housing is going to be referred to as a home. Basic human rights, well, it's going to be kind of straightforward, but specifically and particularly in this case, the rights of children. And the thesis is thus then. The United States federal government should sign and ratify the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of a Child. The criterion we're going to use to weigh today's debate is one that policymakers should use and will come as a shock to all of you, I'm sure, cost-benefit analysis. The cost against the benefits, and you see which one comes out on top, not necessarily just of an economic level, but also philosophical as well. It allows fair ground for both. We do feel that our link is justified for three major reasons. First, it allows real-world debate as every day the document sits on the table without the United States signing it. Secondly, it mirrors the intent of the resolution. Within the document, demands that child be given home and shelter, and that's a specific provision within the document, and therefore affirms the concept that housing should be a basic human right. In addition, it also provides fair ground, as it is not currently done in status quo, so there's got to be some ground there to be had. First, then, we're going to look at the immorality of the United States federal government by not signing this document. First, every country in the world has signed this document except two, Somalia, which doesn't have a government, and, the United States. As the document was being formed, the United States added a lot of reservations and had a direct hand in the composing of this document. And then, they didn't even bother to sign it. It is absolutely immoral, the practice that we use. The United States non-signing makes either one of two statements. But before I get to that statement, I'll take a question.
Thank you. Now, I guess we're just going to have to take your word for it, at least I am, but why hasn't the United States yet signed this document?
I'll tell you this. That's something you're going to have to tell me. Because to me, it sends one of the two statements. First, it shows either that children are unimportant to the United States, or secondly, that at the very least, we don't care enough to recognize this very important and valuable document. Moving on into the second convention, that is, the United States' refusal to sign actually harms the international image. It demonstrates that the United States does not negotiate in good faith. We discussed, we shaped this document, and then just ran away when time came to sign. That is not exactly the most moral stance to take. Everyone in the world signed it, and we have it. Because we have not signed, we are also not allowed to sit in on the councils that form international law on children's issues and children's rights. Take, for instance, the example of Ireland, who is contemplating the idea that that abortion should be considered under this concept. Well, the United States right now, without telling you whether it's right or wrong, abortion isn't out of this debate completely, but without taking a stance on it, the United States right now would have no say in whether this was actually occurring. We have no means to sit on these councils as we have not ratified the document. We can't even enter into negotiations on the matter. Moving that into the third convention, that is how the United States signing solves for a whole lot of problems. Well, first, it increases the legitimacy of the treaty because of the United States. We are obviously recognized as the foremost world power right now, sorry, Russia, and as such, we have a right, and when we sign it, it automatically increases the legitimacy of the document. It also allows the United States to sit in on the decision-making body and put their opinion in. The rights of the citizens of the United States and our government on the issue of children's rights is a vital one, and right now we have no say. Also, the Charter recognizes, and this is some specifics of the Charter in case the opposition team is looking for them. Basically, one of the provisions is that within five years of signing the document, they have to submit a report as to the status of children's rights and the treatment of children within the country. If they are inadequate, they must then resubmit every 2 years until fixed. And in doing so, this opens the door to United Nations sanctions, and it also allows the door for Security Council action. And with that, I'll take your second question.
At least as far as it applies to the United States, how inadequate is our provision for children having housing?
As far as the United States goes? Well, the first thing I will tell you is this. The United States, as the foremost world power, has a responsibility to ensure that the world's children is actually taken care of, not just within the only United States. But in addition and beyond that, the status of the United States would actually help and prove as a great example and help further ratify this document as being valuable, as we are a country with good children's care. And by signing the document, we show that people with good children's care actually believe and support this document. It just makes us one of the staunchest supporters of it. Moving then into the fourth convention for you there. Because the United States has the largest intelligence gathering, we can best inform and verify. We have a lot of resources at our disposal, and when used with the Security Council, we can best tell if other countries are infringing upon the rights of children, and this is a very vital concept. And, I'd love to, I'm sorry, I've got to move on, I've got a lot of stuff to get to. Moving then into the most important stuff, the benefits for the cost-benefit analysis. First, it increases the United States' international legitimacy. This is something that can't be undervalued. As every other nation in the world has signed it, in us doing so, it allows us to ally with them further and increases our legitimacy.
legitimacy
and a lot. Secondly, it increases the legitimacy of the document in and of itself. By the United States signing it, the United States being a country with good child care within its country, it actually shows the idea that this document is a valid and important one. Our ratifying this signifies just the importance and the pivotal nature of this document. Third, it increases the enforcement of rights around the world, or at least in this case, especially when we refer to housing for all, which is the resolution in today's debate. What's important to keep in mind is while we like to be egocentric on the side of the United States and believe that all of our rights are the only things we need to worry about, as a leader, we do need to worry about everyone's rights. It sounds a little mamby-pamby, I know, but it's true. We have a responsibility to maintain the world's rights as well, and it's something that we need to focus on. It's a part of our social responsibility. Finally, it allows sanctions and Security Council's ability, it also allows the Security Council's ability to present issues in front of the United States, which it has not been able to up until this point. When the United States is around, the document can't be talked of, and the issues cannot be brought up when they're dealing with the United Nations. We will remove this restriction. It also increases awareness about kids' rights and children's rights, and allows to bring about more rights in addition. And also, the last thing I'll tell you is it completes a simple social contract, because who needs anything more than children do? And I urge you, for these reasons, because the benefits are so clear, to vote for the government.
Now call upon the Leader of the Opposition, Jeff Brodack.
I didn't even think about it until the Prime Minister discussed it, but I guess I too will probably never, ever, ever have an Academy Award given to me. And while I guess it didn't really affect me beforehand, I assume I feel bad, but I'm not really sure exactly what that feeling is. But I won't go on like Roberto Benigni and say how much I'd like to thank you all and exactly what ways I would like to thank you. But I do have some thank yous of my own that I would definitely like to offer as well. And first and foremost on my list would be to thank Dr. Trask and the tournament staff and the executive committee here for such an excellent tournament and for his years of dedicated service as well. But also, of the 4 years that I have attended the national tournament, no one has put on a better show with better weather and better scenery and probably even better food than Skip Rutledge has here. But I, too, like our friends from Creighton, would like to thank Marty Burkholz for his influence in being part of CSU. I think he's had quite a coup having 3 of the 4 semifinals actually be under his tutelage. I think that in and of itself is an extraordinary accomplishment, and thank you. But not to try to diminish Robert and Marcus's accomplishments, I think they too have been integral in Bill and I's achievements and helping us actually achieve this status of the final round, as well as helping the team like stick together. And that's the next people that I'd like to thank, is specifically Kevin, Susan, Christina, and Cheryl for sitting here today and watching us and supporting us in the round, but also supporting us for the last 3 years and helping us to actually have some of the best practice rounds I think I've ever had. But finally, I think most importantly, at least for me, is my family, who's driven all the way out from Colorado to come see me today. And I think it's been great that they've been in the back of every one of our rounds and have been supportive and have clapped in the whole 9 yards. I think it's great. I love having a traveling parliament. So thank you, Mom and Dad and my grandparents and my aunt. And finally, since it's probably in all of your more recent memories, I have another extension of thank yous to Mr. Bill Herman for being an excellent colleague, an excellent debater, and an excellent friend over these last several years. So finally, thank you, members of Parliament and distinguished colleagues, for your recognition today. And with that, we would like to begin the opposition's philosophy. when we are discussing the resolution, that housing should be a basic human right. I guess I was just expecting to actually discuss housing policy either internationally or nationally. And I think, unfortunately, this is the first place where I think we have to begin our discussion, is when the members of the government would like to talk about the entire United Nations Covenant on Children's Rights. And I think my first argumentation here is it covers a lot more things than housing, members of the Parliament. And you'll realize that the Prime Minister spent a very, very, very minuscule part of his 7 minutes actually discussing the needs of children, either in the United States as far as housing, or around the world, or how the United States not signing this document is somehow preventing housing policy. But instead, he'd rather discuss these larger terms about the value of these children's rights documents. I would say I think this is clearly outside of the realm of what we should be discussing today. And if we're going to discuss whether or not we should uphold this covenant with child housing rights in it or not, and I think when we're going to discuss that better debate, I think quite clearly you will side to oppose. But the Prime Minister wants to say that this is a real-world debate and therefore we should discuss it. And fine, but we should discuss it on real-world terms of the value of housing being a basic human right and not a whole bunch of other things, which I don't really think would be hard to remain today. But yes, we do have also having a mirror of the intent, at least some way, but I think overall we need to examine the specifics of the resolution today and not spend more than 5 to 10 seconds talking about housing. And that's, I think, the best ground for debate and is best going to be at least what we were planning on discussing through this resolution. So with that in mind, the first argument the opposition would like to levy is to why we should not have this document contain at least a basic right to housing is very important. Because what we're going to contend to, at least on the side of the opposition, is that there is a clear delineation between what is shelter and what is housing. The example is you have someone who lives in a shelter, but you still would call them homeless. You'd have someone who should be provided a roof over their head, and those people still don't have housing. They may have some type of shelter. Now, while it may be appropriate that children should have the basic right to shelter, I think when we go beyond that and say they have a basic right to housing, this is placing a lot of extraordinary obligations, especially at the point where we call it a basic human right, and expand that beyond just something that's an important need that we should try to fulfill. Your question, sir?
It seems to me that the opposition is wandering into the main issue here. Could you please clear up the opposition's definition of shelter versus home versus housing?
What we're telling you is housing is presenting some type of permanent actual fixture. And shelter is actually trying to just provide maybe a roof over their heads, like a homeless shelter or some other type of thing. And our argument today is that once you establish it, the house, the actual concrete, solid foundation that these children return to time and time again as not only an international goal that we'd like to achieve, but rather a basic human right that everyone has the responsibility of upholding, that not just harms the United States, but probably not as much, as it harms the rest of the world. Because then it demands, it puts that obligation of devoting massive amounts of resources into building these permanent settlements for children. And at the point where we give the children that right, we don't really establish when that right goes away and kick them out into a non-housing environment. Now, what we're telling you today is that the rest of the world has a far lower economic status than the United States. And once we put this obligation upon them to actually build the physical dwellings and deal with this problem as a basic human right and not just something that's the goal that we should be achieving, that diverts resources from much other very necessary procedures and paths within their government, and that actually ends up harming the children more by demanding that it be a basic human right. So that's our first argument overall, is that we should not be couched in the basic human rights terms, because that doesn't actually help us deal with the problem. But the first argument of the Prime Minister is that the United States is absolutely immoral by not signing this document. Well, my first argumentation today is that's really not germane today. We are going to discuss whether or not we should sign a document that contains a housing provision or not, and that's the debate we are having. But when he second tells us it's saying it's harming our international image, my first argumentation here is that really hasn't impacted us very negatively overall. But furthermore, But furthermore, there aren't people saying, look, the United States isn't providing enough for its children, and therefore we're causing all this international illegitimacy. We don't believe it's a basic human right now, but we're still very good at providing services for children. But when you couch that and try to say this absolutely has to occur on an international level, it's not the best policy I think we should pursue. Your question.
Now, let me get this straight. The United States says that people have a right to be free of torture. We don't generally torture people in the United States. Why can't we say that children have a basic right to housing, even though we can put them pretty well housed in the United States?
Because there's a difference. I think the difference I've already explained to you between couching it as a need and a goal and a basic human right that imposes such an obligation. But the next argument of the Prime Minister is that what it's going to do is we can't sit in on rights discussions and actually tell Ireland what their abortion policy should be. Member of the Parliament, this isn't germane to the resolution at any level. And I furthermore would say to you, why should the United States care what abortion policy in Ireland is? I think this, our not being part of this document today is really not causing any international problem or harming any achievement of the other countries that have signed onto this document. And for that reason, I think that we clearly must be opposing on that. But the next argument given to you by the Prime Minister is that what it's actually signing will actually help the United States become a very legitimate power. Well, I think I've already shown to you it doesn't help or harm our legitimacy any by not saying it's not a basic human right, but just something that we should try to achieve. But furthermore, we say, well, now you have to report to countries, and all the rest of this great document is really, really good, and we've got good intelligence. Well, what you need to realize is other countries have the ability to deal with children with or without the United States actually being a party to this document. Furthermore, how many children in Somalia aren't getting housing because the CIA isn't publishing a report to the Security Council members of Parliament? This is not a problem that I think that is clearly being dealt with. So when the Prime Minister discusses his advantages, he wants to revisit the legitimacy argument, and I think I've already effectively dealt with that. But furthermore, he says we're going to lend legitimacy to the document. I would say this is outside of the context of least of our discussions today. We're not debating whether or not children should have any rights whatsoever on the international community. We're debating whether or not children should be afforded, mandated through international law, this specific right of housing. And furthermore, I would tell you that when he says that the United States can do it and we have to enforce the morality and teach other people what to do, I think that in and of itself would probably be a reason to reject the document as a whole. Because if the United States wants to justify its position as far as human rights, saying, we're in the United States and we've got a lot of guns, so damn it, we're going to tell you the best rights to have and we need to be in on all these discussions, when the Prime Minister specifically tells us we need to be party to these investigations so we can tell other countries what to do, I think as a parliament we should reject the document simply because the United States would abuse that type of privilege by just running around saying, this is what you've got to do because we're Bill Clinton in the U.S. And then finally, he tells us that this upholds some type of conflict. And I would contend to you that nowhere has he explained to you how specifically saying housing is a right upholds the social contract, increases legitimacy, or helps the world in any sort of way. For the first time, we urge you to oppose.
I now call upon the member of government, Brian Matthews.
I guess, of course, it's my obligation to bring to you a couple of more thank yous that I feel have gone neglected so far in the people that we've thanked. And the one person, or the two people I want to thank most of all is, of course, Jason Speck and Jonathan Lang, who possibly gives the easiest semifinal round of all time. In all seriousness, we certainly could not be here right now without the support that our teammates have given us, the support that our coaches have given us, and the support that everyone else at this tournament has given us. And I certainly thank everyone, and I appreciate everyone to a great extent. The next thank you I'd like to extend is to people who do not get thanked enough, and that is a personal thank you that I'd like to extend to my high school debate coach, Phil Davis. And I don't think we recognize enough the importance that high school teaches us, and particularly the debating skills that these people have outlined for us and the fundamental building blocks they've given us. So I'd just like to say thank you to him and every other high school debate coach. And I guess finally, the last person I'd like to thank would be, or the last two would be Jeff Brodak and Bill Herman themselves. In my very first round at Colorado College, I debated Bill Herman. In my very last round of my high school career, my college career, I also debate Bill Herman. I think that we've been friends all along, and I just want to thank you for that. Finally, I would like to thank my parents, who much like Jeff, will be watching the final round. They kindly went out and purchased a new VCR and got rid of the old Betamax machine they had so they can watch videos of it. Yeah. That's it. Speaking of basic human rights, I would like to talk about housing and children. And while he might seem childish, I would agree that Mr. Bill Herman does deserve to have a home and a shelter put over his head. That said, we move to the motion presented before this House, that housing should be a basic human right. The Leader of the Opposition has some qualms with the way that we have established today's debate. I would like to begin by addressing those, move through the government's case in turn, and then finally return to the one line of opposition analysis. We first hear from the Leader of the Opposition that the government, that the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights covers more than housing. With this, I will certainly agree. It does cover more than housing, but it still covers housing. There is no other international treaty, nor document, nor mechanism that we can use to establish housing as a basic human right. This, simply put, is the best one that we have available, and we should finally pick it up off the table and sign it. Second, we hear from the estimate of the opposition that how does the United States not signing this somehow bring its inculcation with the idea that this is a human right? The speakers of this House, we are not saying that the resolution demands that homes be built for people. Rather, the resolution demands a recognition that housing is a basic human right, and that recognition comes from the signing of the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of the Child. That is the first and the only place that housing is recognized as a basic human right under international law, and it's dawn time the United States did something about it. That said, I urge you to remember the criterion of cost-benefit analysis. And please note that while Mr. Brodak gives you an eloquent speech, he never demonstrates any cost to the government's proposal. And insofar as we can demonstrate benefit, you certainly side with the government. Finally, we turn down to the reasons why this is justified. First, it is real world. Now, Mr. Brodak tells us that it is fine to discuss real world implications of housing. I guess that's why we do vocal warmth for speeches, huh? But the real world implications of housing and it being a basic human right. And we do. The real world implication of that is the signing of this physical piece of paper, document, and treaty, and abiding by it under international law. But I'll talk even more about Mr. Brodak's line of analysis in a moment. But second, we know that it mirrors the resolution. And Mr. Brodak tells us that, as a general whole, overall, it does not mirror it. But speakers of this House, it certainly does mirror the resolution. Housing should be a basic human right. If we wish to recognize that as the United States under international law, there is one and only one avenue we can go about through doing it. We didn't want to stand before you and tell you that the United Nations should convene every single country in the world to come into a room like this and debate whether or not housing is a basic human right. It's already been done for us. It's called the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of the Child, and we should begin to adopt it. That said, we turn to the first line of government analysis, the immorality of the United States government. Mr. Brodak tells us that this is not germane to the debate, but it certainly is, that this is the only avenue in which to support housing as a basic and fundamental tenet of human rights. Please note that every country in the world has signed this document but two, the United States and Somalia, speakers of the House and members of Parliament. But more importantly than that, please note that the United States amended the treaty, revised the treaty, and had specific United States and Amerocentric ideas placed into the treaty. Please then note the argument that Mr. Brodak makes against the social contract that tells us that it is poor policy to export our social rights, and it's a poor policy for the United States to export its morals to other nations. We've already done it with the treaty. We might as well fess up to it and sign it and begin to live and abide by it. Certainly.
So what if that action of the United States actually forcing its rights on the rest of the world is a bad thing? Can we just do it because we've done it before?
No. The rest of the world has already accepted what the United States said. The fact that everyone signed it but us shows that they accept it, but most importantly, the United States should accept it also. That said, we turn to the second line of government analysis, that this harms international integrity. We hear from Mr. Burke that this doesn't impact us greatly overall, but with this I would fundamentally disagree. Why? Because we cannot sit on any board now that discusses children's rights or housing rights. Second, we cannot sit on any board that discusses particularly this treaty in general, which means that should this treaty be used, should be enforced anywhere about the world, we can't consider it. Should the United States be unable to consider it, the Security Council can't consider it since we are a permanent member of that council. That renders the treaty meaningless, Speakers of the House and members of Parliament, and I would urge you to lend that treaty some meaning. But finally, we hear from the Leader of the Opposition, no thank you, sir, about Ireland. The point about Ireland is this, not that Ireland wants a domestic law to outlaw abortion, but that Ireland wants an international law outlawing abortion. And so long as the United States hasn't signed the treaty, the United States can put no say into the issue. This, Speakers of the House, whether abortion be right or wrong, should the law be passed under international and international guidelines, would hold severe ramifications and impacts for the United States and only illustrates our need to sign the treaty and let our will be known. That says, no thank you. That says we turn to the third line of government analysis. That United States signing will fundamentally solve the problem. It increases the legitimacy of the treaty. It actually allows something to get done. And most importantly, it allows us to sit on the decision-making body. While Mr. Glorak might tell you that it has harmed the legitimacy of the United States overall, that's well and good. But we are presenting to you clear benefits of the government proposal, and without any disadvantage to weigh it against, you still side with the government. Finally, we turn to the final, next line of analysis brought to the side of the opposition. That other countries have the ability to develop children's rights, and should the CIA not be informing people about Somalia, how is that going to hurt us? Simply put, it hurts us this way. Should Russia submit a report to this council and this decision-making body? The decision-making body has literally no ability to validate that report. The United States, with its intelligence and decision-making abilities, can influence that and can help the body become more legitimate. Finally, we turn to the benefits. We again see the cross-application of the Leader of Opposition's arguments previously, and so I urge you to simply remember what I've already told you. The only new line of analysis brought to us by the Leader of the Opposition is that of the exportation of the United States' morals and ideals and ideologies. Speaker of the House, realize we've already done it. We've already gone into the treaty room and the treaty chamber, and we've complained about the treaty. We've amended the treaty. We've put American-centric ideas into the treaty, and then we didn't even bother to sign it. I would contend to this House that it is most unjust for us to leave the piece of paper, the treaty, sitting on our desk after we've worked so hard for it. It is unjust to the children, it is unjust to the rest of the world, and it fundamentally violates the rights that we hold dear. Finally, then, say, we turn to the line of opposition's analysis. And this is where it seems the opposition would like the debate to focus, whether or not we should accept housing as a basic human right, and I will prove to you that we do. First, it is what the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of the Child demands, so this is still a resolutional debate. But second, realize that insofar as every other country in the world has signed and recognized the document, that demonstrates to us that it is virtually a universal human right, if the only outliers are the United States and Somalia, who can't even sign the treaty. But next, it's a clear basic human right because of the right to life. And we have a right to life and a right to be protected insofar as we need shelter and homes to protect us from the basic elements of man or from basic elements of nature. We realize that it's a basic human right. But the next reason why it's a basic human right is it upholds the right to culture, also outlined in the document. Why is this? Because I would contend to this House, we need only look to communicative theories of setting to realize that housing and what aspect and what you live fundamentally influences your culture, shapes your norms, values, and beliefs, and insofar as people have a right to that, they have a right to a home over their heads. But the final thing that I would point out to you again, Speaker of the House, is that the resolution doesn't demand that we go about building structures for people, only recognize that this right exist. Certainly some people will stand in violation of it. Let us bring them under sanction of international law through the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of the Child. We beg you, Speakers of the House and members of Parliament, to propose.